Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today, writer-director Nora Ephron tells us about her other love, cooking and having people in to eat. Her dinner parties are nearly the stuff of legends. She's going to tell us how she stopped worrying and learned to enjoy entertaining. This is not your same old bunch of tips. She breaks a lot of rules. We have the best ice creams in America from the man who tastes everything, David Rosengarten. And by the by, he has found a real bargain sleeper. Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Bremsen is working on a book on the 100 greatest dishes of the world. Today, she has a connoisseur's guide to authentic paella. With the butter craze going full tilt, we're going to go to the source. We talk with a man who's been making butter for over 40 years. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get the show on the road with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. So, Jane, Michael, what's the latest discovery?
Well, I'm going to start telling you what it is, Lynn, although since it's hot dogs, Michael will instantly take over the microphone and not stop talking till the end of our time with you.
It's not Chicago hot dogs, though.
No, it's true. It's not. It's Flo's hot dogs in Cape Natick. Or Natick, I'm not sure how they pronounce it, Cape Natick, Maine. These are tiny little pink hot dogs that you really eat by the half dozen, and they are highly addictive.
You mean they're on tiny little rolls, too?
Tiny? Well, they're not tiny isn't quite the right. They're small hot dogs, maybe 3 good-sized bites per dog. They're pink, they're pale, they're served in these kind of spongy, soft rolls. They're like little wonderful airy snacks. I mean, they're totally different from the kind of hot dog that I've talked endlessly about in Chicago, the all-beef hot dogs. These are kind of lightweight hot dogs, but impossible to stop eating. What makes them truly great, aside from just the dog itself, is the hot relish. Flo's has been famous for hot relish for decades, ever since Flo herself ran it. It's now run by her daughter-in-law. It's a wonderful relish, not at all like chili, no meat in it. It's a very spicy, hot onion relish, kind of a little sweet, a little hot, and somehow it brings these, let's say, mundane hot dogs into the stratosphere, because there's something about the relish that combines with the porky dogs that is just a wonderful bite of food.
What I love about Flo's is just the ambiance of the place. It is a classic road food, roadside diner. It's a little six stool place by the side of the road with a swinging mesh door that has a sign on it that says, please keep door closed. And of course, when you go through it, the door stays open and somebody yells at you to close the door. Six little stools at the counter inside. Flo's daughter-in-law making the relish and the hot dogs and passing it out to you from this little window behind the counter.
What I love about Flo's is there is no menu. You walk into the restaurant, and when Gail Stacey, the person who runs it now, sees you, she looks at you and says, how many? That's it. And you tell her you want 4, you want 6, you want 8 hot dogs, depending on what your appetite is. There is one other choice you have to make, which is, do you want your hot relish with mayonnaise or with mustard? Now, this takes the hot dog in 2 completely different directions. The mayonnaise and hot sauce is unspeakably luxurious. It's hot, it's rich, there's something about it that is just kind of overwhelmingly luscious. With mustard, it becomes hot and sassy. It's 2 completely different ways to take the very same hot dog.
So I've got to order 3 with mustard and 3 with mayo, which, by the way, sounds like the greatest Russian island dressing, whatever that is.
Russian thousand million
whatever island. Yeah, yes. the mayo and the hot relish. But, you know, the only one thing I'm wondering about is when you said a Cape in Maine, no lobster roll, only hot dogs.
Absolutely no lobster rolls whatsoever. Cape Natick is near York, Maine. If you want lobster rolls, there are plenty of great places to get them elsewhere. If you want hot dogs, you got to go to Flo's.
Okay.
No hamburgers, no nothing. Just little hot dogs with hot sauce.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Okay, Lynn, take care.
Bye, Lynn.
love's all right, but it don't take the place of home.
Aye, aye, aye.
Your love's all right, but it don't take the place of home.
Aye, aye.
I've been eating so many red hots, I'm barking like a collie dog.
I have no idea where they find these things. Jane and Michael Stern's newest book is the update of their great classic, Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their Road Food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. David Rosengarten of wine expert, cookbook author, and food TV fame has started a food and wine newsletter, The Rosengarten Report. He tastes all kinds of foods, evaluates them, and then shares his picks. David, welcome back.
Great to be here, as always, with you, Lynn.
So what has been passing over the golden palate?
Well, in time for the heat of the summer, I've been tasting ice creams. Happily so. Hundreds of ice creams from around the country.
You know, is there a definition of a great ice cream for you?
It's funny how much closer you get to a definition when you're tasting 300 of something.
Oh my goodness.
But the thing that really became apparent to me was that I liked ice creams either because they had insanely accurate, authentic, intense flavors of whatever the flavor is supposed to be. You know, if you have a coffee ice cream and somebody sits around and goes, "That reminds me of the Ethiopian beans from Irgachev." You know, I mean, that's, and I'm calling that the yuppie factor. But then there's the kid factor. Other ice creams I liked, they had none of that whatsoever, but they just had like this apotheosis of dairy quality, you know, just made you feel like a little kid on mother's milk. So that's what I look for, either one or the other or a combination of the two.
Is there anything on the label that can tell us if the ice cream is going to be really great or less than great?
Yeah. Right. This is so confusing because there are ice creams, as you well know, that have long lists of ingredients with all that scary stuff in there, carrageenan, locust, bean gum, whatever that is, guar gum. And you would think that maybe they should be avoided. Some of the best ice creams with some of the best textures in our tasting had that stuff on the label. Also, another surprise is that very often if you see milk as an initial ingredient, you might think, well, it's going to be less rich.
Mm-hmm.
But as you well know, Lynn, most of the beautiful gelati that are made in Italy are made with more milk than cream. So it's not a question of milk or cream, so you can't tell from that either. So in other words, the answer to your question is no, I think you can't tell from the label.
Okay, well, can you tell me the top three, for instance, your picks?
Yes. I'm so passionate about these. There is a fancy French restaurant just north of New York City called La Crémaillère. It's been open for many years and has always made great ice cream in the restaurant. Maybe two years ago, they decided to market the ice cream that's made right in their kitchen. And their strawberry ice cream, which is made from a combination of French and Italian wild strawberries that are shipped here in puree, and Driscoll strawberries from California, is the most intense, wonderful strawberry ice cream I've ever tasted, and the rest are great also. Number two, last year I did an ice cream spot on television on the Today Show, and I did not include an ice cream called Graters from Cincinnati. I never got so many emails in my life. Everybody from the Midwest said, "How could you leave out Graters?" So this time we put it in, and it came in number two. It's absolutely wonderful, old-fashioned, rich ice cream from Cincinnati. Now, number three is really intriguing because I flipped when I tasted it. I got it from a guy in Wisconsin. He's got a website, icecreamsource.com, and he sort of stocks ice creams, and you can buy ice creams from him. He's like an ice cream negociant. He ships them, yeah. So I tasted this ice cream, which is called Jeremy's Micro Batch from Philadelphia, and I called him up, and I said, "Oh, my God, this is so great." He said, "Oh, yeah, well, they're bankrupt." I said, "Ah, well, why did you send it to me?" He said, "Because I've got 100 pints of each flavor you tasted in my vault." And he's holding them for readers of my newsletter, of the Rosengarten Report. And I would definitely urge your listeners to try to get a taste of either the triple espresso or the vanilla ice cream that they call Wired. They're like relics now. They're holy relics, but they're unbelievable.
A collector's ice cream.
Yes, exactly.
All right, but David, quite frankly, this is all kind of esoteric if I've got a mail order an ice cream. How did the supermarket ice creams rate?
Ah, right. Well, you know, first of all, let me just say that the mail ordering is not such a bad thing, because every ice cream we received, 300, they all came in perfect condition. But
uh-huh.
I understand what you're saying. It's a bit of a pain in the neck. So we did include nationally available supermarket ice creams and some that weren't nationally available. Generally speaking, they did fine. I mean, I think that, you know, Breyers is a good product. It doesn't quite have the electricity and the excitement of the smaller ice creams. And by the way, Ben and Jerry's and Häagen-Dazs both did extremely well in our tasting, though not quite as well as the three I mentioned before.
Right.
However, Lynn, what I'm anxious to tell you about is there's an ice cream that's made in Iowa. It's called Blue Bunny, and it sounds very exotic to those of us in New York, but I imagine it's in supermarkets in the Midwest all over the place. It was good. It was really good. The vanilla had that kind of, you know, old-time cream cheese-like glow in the finish that I look for in my great kid-like ice cream. And though some ice creams in our tasting went up to $7 a pint, Blue Bunny is as cheap as 81 cents a pint.
So the price-quality ratio is really great.
Insane, yes.
And I've been walking past this in my supermarket.
Try that
for
Blue
years.
Bunny. Especially try the vanilla and the double strawberry and the bunny tracks. You got to try that.
Bunny tracks. Okay.
Yeah.
Blue Bunny ice cream in the supermarket. Otherwise, mail order all the greats and do get the collector's ice cream.
Absolutely.
David, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
David Rosengarten is creator of the Rosengarten Report newsletter. You can find information on his ice cream picks on our website, splendidtable.org. David really got to me with this one. So I went out and I bought some Blue Bunny vanilla, and last weekend we made these sundaes. I've dubbed them Hot Fudge Double Chocolate Fresh Cherry Sundaes. Now, the idea is you work fresh cherries and crushed chocolate bar into the ice cream, and then you top it with the hot fudge. Now, the key is not only the fresh cherries, but this chocolate bar that I can't stop playing with. It's kind of chocolate on chocolate, bittersweet with crunchy nibs of cocoa beans. Now, it's by this French chocolatier named Michel Cluizel. It's in the stores, and it's also on our website at the Splendid Table store. That's splendidtable.org, and by the way, the recipe is on the site, too. Coming up, Nora Ephron with a fresh take on entertaining, authentic paella, better butter, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. Novelist and filmmaker Nora Ephron tipped us off to her love of eating and cooking in her novel Heartburn. She punctuated this story of the unraveling of her marriage with dishes and dinner parties. Numerous films and books later, Nora Ephron is still giving dinner parties. In fact, ones that are almost legendary for the fun that everybody has. So for some advice on how to stop worrying and enjoy entertaining, we have Nora Ephron on the phone. Nora, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
So, Nora, have you actually been spending time making a study of this idea of having people over for a meal?
Well, you mean recently?
Yeah.
No, I feel like I've sort of nailed it down at this point in my life.
So, how did you nail it down? I guess that's the big question.
Well, I think from screwing up continually over a period of years and then trying to figure out why what I was doing wasn't as relaxed as what other people were doing. And I began kind of furtively looking around at other people's dinner parties, trying to figure out if there were formulas or secrets. And, of course, there aren't really, but I did end up, largely from watching several of my friends, one of whom, Lee Bailey, is a pretty famous cookbook writer, and who just gave the most kind of wonderful and almost, they almost seemed, I don't want to say this wrong, but they almost seemed kind of hapless. You couldn't figure out how they'd happened. He was the opposite of that sort of nervous host or hostess who's always fretting and worrying that dinner is too late or that the meat isn't going to come out at the same time as the starch and all the things that seemed to be, you know, a problem with other people's dinner parties, you know. So I began watching at Lee's, and I discovered, you know, all sorts of things that seemed to me to be, in some way, solutions.
Well, like what, for instance?
Well, like a round table. Oh. I really became a sort of religious fanatic about round tables. My first theory about Lee's parties was that the reason they worked and the reason mine weren't as good was that I had rectangular tables and he had round tables, so I immediately bought a round table, and it changed everything, because there's only one conversation, or there can be one conversation at a round table, and there almost can never be one conversation at a long, narrow table. So people are always sort of stuck with whoever they're stuck with, and they don't have a chance to get unstuck by talking to the people at the other side. That was one thing that is just, you know, whenever I go to someone's house and I see a long table, I just think, oh, well, too bad. This won't be fun. It's true.
But it makes good sense. It's like everybody lined up on a couch. You talk to the wall. You don't talk to each other.
Yeah.
What else?
What else? Well, one thing that Lee always did, by the way, dinner was always way too late at Lee's. Way, way, way too late. People were just practically dying from hunger. Now, I don't do that, but it is really a good thing to do because the people have that little, you know, it's, of course, politically incorrect to suggest that people have another drink at your parties, but the truth is that, you know, a well-oiled group always has a little bit more fun, but that is not something I actually do. I definitely learned, though, that you could be very relaxed and that one of the things Lee does is that he always had this thing that I began to think of as the rule of four. There was always a fourth thing on the menu. Most people serve, you know, a piece of meat or chicken or fish and a vegetable and a starch. That's sort of what everyone thinks goes on a plate at a dinner. But Lee always had some fourth thing. He always made biscuits, or he had some sort of fabulous pepper jelly from the South, or pickles, or once he had, with a pork dish, he had made tiny little baked crab apples. He used a lot of fruit with meat, which I just love. And it always made the dinner the menu just got more, it felt like more fun to eat it. And you know, an important thing about serving dinner, by the way, is that you want people to have seconds, and you want them, if you have four things on the plate, then all the tastes can kind of change in combination with one another. And it makes you want to go on eating. The last thing you want at a dinner, by the way, is for people to just eat it and be done 7 minutes later after you've gone to so much trouble to make it. Which is, by the way, another thing I learned from Lee. I never serve fish, ever, because
Why?
It's too easy to eat. Fish just goes down in a jiffy. You just eat it, you're done with it. It melts in your mouth. It doesn't require any hard work like cutting with a knife and fork, which really does keep people at the table longer, sawing away. And by the way, sawing away always makes people want to eat a little bit more because they feel as if they're burning calories as they're eating. So these things are very important when you're serving a dinner. You want people to kind of be able to play with their food in the nicest possible way.
So you're saying have them starving to death. Give them that little extra, that something extra they don't expect, that they make them work for their food, have a round table. Is there anything else? Oh, and no fish.
No fish. Also, he had no hors d'oeuvres, ever. Sometimes he put out a big bowl of raw peas in the pod, and so you would have like three little peas or something. And that didn't come at the beginning. That sort of came when people were almost dying of starvation. Then he would kind of throw them out as a sort of tease. And you were never quite sure if you weren't eating the vegetable course as you were doing it. But I'm afraid that one of the things I'm probably fairly inadequate at is those little hors d'oeuvres with cocktails. I just serve a lot of good peanuts and things.
So Nora, what are you working on now?
I have a play coming out in the fall Broadway.
What's the name of it?
It's called Imaginary Friends.
Okay. We will look for this. And thank you.
You're very welcome.
Nora Ephron spoke to us from her home on Long Island. Now, in the spirit of Lee Bailey's approach to entertaining, I've come up with a menu. There's a few recipes and several ideas for simple dishes, like, for instance, a golden rice pilau that's good at room temperature, a cantaloupe chili basil salad, and barbecued ribs. Oh, and that hot chocolate cherry fudge sundae for dessert. You can find it all on the website, splendidtable.org. Anya von Bremsen is a concert pianist turned food professional. She roams the world for Travel and Leisure magazine and is now working on a book, The 100 Great Dishes of the World. Anya, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Anya, I want to talk about what I think of as being Spain's national dish, paella. What is paella like in Spain?
Well, paella in Spain can be as erratic and wrong as paella in America. I mean, it's a little bit better in Spain, but really it all depends where you are in Spain, because paella is one of those terms that people just throw out and they think they're talking about saffron rice. It's usually mushy and it has sausages and chicken and lobster. And that's the kind of paella that even in Spain they serve to tourists, unless you go to the birthplace of paella, which is to say Valencia, Alicante, Catalonia, from north to south, you know, where this dish originated. And there, the definition becomes obsessively rigid. You know, a real paella, a paella valenciana, has to be prepared with a certain kind of rice that is grown in the region, and it's either calasparra or bomba rice. It has to include snails and rabbit. It has to be done in a paella pan, which is a shallow, open pan with two handles. And it has to be done outside on the grill with vine cuttings or orange tree shoots. And, you know, the method is very precise. The taste is very precise. But, of course, the definition is, even in those regions, is used quite flexibly. You can have a seafood paella, though the traditionalists will argue that this is not a paella. It just has to be called rice arroz with something else.
So where can we go in those places to taste the real thing?
Well, anywhere you go in Valencia, you will get a nice authentic paella, either in Valencia City or in Albufera, which is a little region outside of Valencia where they produce rice. But even better than Valencia, and this is a secret not even known in Spain, are the paellas in Alicante, which is, you know, a neighboring region. And if you're ever in Alicante, you should go to a restaurant like Poblet or Pegoli in Denia, or Piripi in Alicante, and they are more creative with their paellas. I mean, they're still very rigidly and authentically prepared, but, you know, chefs kind of indulge in flights of fancy. And this is also where they produce this rice called bomba, that has a perfect starch structure for making a paella. And Lynn, you would not believe it, it can absorb up to 4 cups of liquid for 1 cup of rice, which is twice the usual. And it still will remain firm. And that's what you want a paella. You want something that is chewy, a little bit firm, but not like risotto. It has to be both spongy and firm, the rice. And, you know, people are obsessive about the texture of the rice. You know, the most important thing if you're making a paella at home is not to overload it with the other ingredients. Remember that the rice is what has to be the memorable centerpiece, and everything else just contributes a little bit of flavor. So no lobster, sausage, and chicken combinations, please.
Okay, now let's focus, though, on making it in our own kitchen. You know, I don't have the orange tree to cut down to start burning out in the backyard. How do you suggest that we do this?
I think the safest way is to do it on the stovetop. If you're very good at regulating the heat of your grill, you just place it on top of the rack, you make your seasonings, a little bit of onion, a little bit of crushed tomato, garlic, then you add the rice and whatever the ingredients you want to put in, and then you add the liquid, which has to be a nice, flavorful broth, and then you let it almost boiled, you know, down to the surface of the rice, almost evaporate, and then you reduce dramatically the temperature of your grill, and you finish cooking, you know, for another 15 minutes or so. And sometimes you want to put a wet towel on top. Sometimes you might want to finish it in the oven just to give it the kind of soft, nice consistency. It's important to use a nice Spanish rice like bomba or calasparra. And I used to schlep this rice in from Spain, and now you can get it through a number of mail order sources. And paella pans are very easily found at better stores, or you can mail order them. It's very easy. It's an amazing dish, but, you know, you have to do it, not exactly in a pure way, but you have to respect that tradition.
But I understand you never stir a paella, and that means that I know you've got this shallow amount of rice, but doesn't the rice on the bottom cook and the top of the rice stays hard?
That's one of the problems. The bottom, actually, you're supposed to get that nice crust, and it's called socarrat, and that's the most delectable part, so that's fine. As far as the top not cooking through, you can put a moist towel on top, and you just let it finish. And it's amazing. It works.
Okay, we're going to give it a try. Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen writes for Travel and Leisure magazine and is working on a book about the 100 greatest dishes of the world. You can get her recipe for paella, it's really more of a treatise, on the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have Marty on the line. Marty, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Marty.
Hi, Marty.
Hi, Lynn. I just want to say Ann and I thoroughly enjoy your presentation. Here's the question.
Well, thank you.
For a long time, you could get pretty not very good brie and camembert in American supermarkets and such, but here of late you've really been able to get some really good stuff from France and Germany and wherever.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is this: they always looked like they were about 3 weeks away from being close to perfection. And how do you ripen them?
Ah, so you want to know how to ripen these, they're essentially soft cheeses.
Right.
Like Brie
and Camembert.
And Camembert yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's logical that they come to us unripe, because when these babies ripen, they go over the hill very quickly.
Well, that's true.
I'm thinking back to, you know, our cheese guy, Steve Jenkins, has talked about ripening.
I just saw a piece on him, as a matter of fact, on Sunday morning.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm rifling through the files in the brain trying to remember. Here's the basic idea. At least what I've seen in France of the way people ripen cheeses. Generally, you want it to be in a cool, airy place without a lot of light. Now, the ideal for us, because our houses are heated and most of us don't have cold cellars, is a refrigerator. Now, cheese absorbs a lot.
How about a cool basement?
If you've got a really cool basement, we're talking 45 degrees.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah, that's the only problem, you see, because it's got to be like 55, 45 degrees. But the idea is you could do it on the shelf in the refrigerator. It may absorb some of the flavors around it, but you give air circulation, put it in the warmest part of the fridge. Now, that's still, you know, 40, 35, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
But take it out of its wrapping.
You want the little baby to breathe. And I'd leave it for 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
And every once in a while, you press it gently. Now, what you're pressing for is, when you press it initially, it's going to be real firm.
Right.
And what you want it to do is to just feel like it has a little give. And the other thing is, you want to take it out of the fridge every so often, let it come up close to room temperature for an hour, and sniff it. Now, if it smells like ammonia, it's over the hill.
Okay.
But
over the hill.
Ammonia and cheese means it is toast. But if it smells, you know, that mushroomy,
right,
sort of funky wonderfulness, it's ripe. It's ripe. Now, once you cut into it, it's hard to age it after that. You can't. But if you're getting a whole little one, I'd say give it a week.
How about a slice? Because I'm...
Slices are tough. Once you cut into that thing, it just seems to not age quite the same way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The best
and, you know,
thing to do is to buy a wheel and let it go that way.
And the really best stuff to look for is raw milk. In French, it will read lait cru, L-A-I-T, and then the word C-R-U. That's
great.
When you're getting the prime stuff.
Oh, well, thanks so very much.
You are welcome.
Enjoy
the cheese.
Bye.
Goodbye. You know, in France, there are actually people whose job it is to ripen cheeses. Great cheese shops will also have in their sign, in their title, affineur. To be an affineur is to be someone who ripens cheeses. Isn't that a classy name? I'd love a business card. Lynn Rossetto Casper, affineur. Let them figure it out. Well, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Now, this week's question is about making ice cream, and it was inspired by David Rosengarten's ice cream tasting. The question is, what's the secret ingredient in the world's best strawberry ice creams? There's a trick here. We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment, but first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia query. It was about ice cream, and it comes from David Rosengarten's ice cream tastings. The question is, what's the secret ingredient to the world's best strawberry ice creams? It's alcohol. Alcohol works magic on any fruit ice cream. It's an old French trick. When you want juicy chunks of fruit instead of hard frozen nuggets, you toss the fruit with fruit-flavored brandy. Now, since alcohol freezes at a lower temperature than the water in the fruit, the chunks stay nice and juicy. And there's more. Alcohol is handy in any ice cream for another reason. More flavors are soluble in alcohol than in any other substance. As little as a half tablespoon in 3 cups of ice cream can make a huge difference. Now, it's easy to spiff up some store-bought vanilla ice cream. Just toss fruit with some sugar and brandy, fold it into the ice cream, and freeze it. Oh, one other piece of ice cream trivia from David Rosengarten. David says that we are serving ice cream too cold. It shouldn't be stone cold. It should be creamy. So you take it out of the freezer 10 to 30 minutes before you need it, stick an instant reading thermometer in it, and when the thermometer reads 15 to 20 degrees, the ice cream is prime. Back to your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Michael on the line. Hey, Michael, what's happening?
Yes, I have a question about grilling.
Yeah?
I'm interested in, it's kind of a basic question, but I'm really interested in doing something that is highly unlikely, something that's really unique and not normally associated with the grill. I've just started cooking seriously. And I would want to make a dish on the grill that's the kind that will give me, like, you know, a sense of achievement, something really different.
Well, if you want a real challenge, and probably one that'll lead to total disaster, you could try doing spaghetti. But now let's back up for a minute. Hey, I've got an idea. Have you ever tried grilling a piece of cheese?
No.
There's this incredible salad. It's done in France, but there's a lot of versions of it. You take a small goat cheese, you know, something that's like a hockey puck.
Sure.
Or a little smaller, and you rub it with a little oil, and you put it over very hot fire very quick so it gets grill marks on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you plop it in the middle of a green salad that you've dressed with oil and vinegar, maybe some shallot and some mustard.
Okay.
And you serve that with the cheese hot and the salad cool. It is incredible because you cut into the cheese, you know, and it kind of goes all over the place. It
okay.
is so good. I try that because everybody will be watching. Everyone will be, you know, sitting there on the edges of their seats because they think the cheese will start to melt, which it could. And you just keep working it with tongs.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. I love you so.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. By the way, that idea of doing cheese, there's another thing you can do. Take a Greek cheese, like I think it's called kasseri. You can find it fairly easily because, believe it or not, there's stuff from Greece, but there's a very decent one produced in Wisconsin by the Stella people. At any rate, slice it about, a quarter to a half inch thick. This is a kind of firm cheese. And do the same thing. Hot wood fire, because you want that woodsiness. And just hit it on the grill. Rub it with olive oil. Hit it on the grill, both sides. It's just going to be on the brink of breaking it. And then plop it on a plate. And sprinkle it with a little bit more olive oil. And sprinkle it with lemon juice. And slather that on chunks of bread. Oh. And if it falls in the fire, it falls in the fire, you know? I mean, you have other slices. Okay, get to us at 800-537-5252. We've got Dave calling. So, Dave, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, this is Dave. I live in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
And I used to eat
Dave, do not show off. Now, okay. We're all envious. Don't show off. We know
yeah, it's nicer right now.
It's
really
nice.
Nicer right now, actually.
It's nice there all the time. But did you have a question?
Yeah. Yeah, I used to go to this Polish restaurant called Stella's.
Yeah?
And they used to have this soup, and it was really good. And the restaurant has since been closed. It's a strip mall when it's closed. That was too bad. But they used to have this soup. It was like a dill pickle soup.
A Polish dill pickle soup?
Yeah, and it was really good. And I had no idea how they make it. It was like a creamy type soup with some vegetables in it.
Uh-huh.
But the dill pickle just made it, you know, like an incredible soup. And I was wondering is that like a common Polish soup or?
Oh, boy. You know what I know about Polish food? You could put into a bowl of soup and have a lot of room left over. There are pickle soups, though, that you find in in places like Poland and Romania and Hungary. The pickle, okay, wait a minute. You want to know how to make this, right?
Yeah. Is it just like a regular, just get a pickle and slice it up and put in the soup, or is it just like a cucumber?
Did it taste kind of pickly?
No, actually it didn't.
Okay.
It didn't.
It
was a while ago since,
yeah,
since I've had the soup, but...
Did it have beets in it by any chance?
No, it had sliced carrots in there and I think some celery.
And it was creamy.
It was real creamy, huh?
Well, I've got an idea for you. A basic idea, because I do know of one soup from Poland. It has beets in it, and it has garlic and sugar, a little sugar, and broth, and an onion. And then you actually have pickles and a little bit of their juice in it. It's out of this world. But this is what I do. Why not make a great cream, sort of a cream of vegetable soup? Do this, all right? Take celery, carrot, and onion. And saute that in a little bit of butter with caraway seed, and I'd throw in a little paprika because I just think that'll have a nice taste. Add some garlic and then add broth to that. Oh, and
like
slice
chicken
up.
Broth?
Yeah, yeah. And slice up some potatoes too and throw those in and simmer everything until it's tender. Stir in, well, let's say for every 6 or 7 cups of soup, stir in 1 cup of cream. And 1/2 cup of sour cream, and 2 dill pickles that you've chopped up.
That sounds good.
And you know what you're going to get? You're going to get kind of, and if you think you'd like it, taste it and see if you want to add a tad of sugar to it. So it's like a sweet, tart, creamy vegetable soup. And I guarantee you, when you have cream and sour cream and something like that with a little dill pickle, it can't be bad. You're going to like it.
Whether,
I don't know if it's that soup, but it'll be tasty.
Okay.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Mark calling. So, Mark, what shall we discuss?
Hello, Lynn. I'm calling today to discuss fish sauce that's used in Thai dishes and Vietnamese dishes.
So now, what about the fish sauces?
Well, I spent some time around Vietnam and the Philippines, and I love the food, and I've cooked Chinese, but whenever I go to the Oriental grocery stores to try to look for a fish sauce to go with recipes, there seems to be a real wide variety of the way they look and the way they taste.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if there's a good way to make your own or if there's a particular kind that you'd typically recommend for especially Thai dishes.
Well, for people who are unfamiliar with the fish sauce we're talking about, it comes out of Thailand and Vietnam. It's almost clear, much clearer than soy sauce. It's very salty, and some people would say it smells like old socks. And it's made by a process where fish is salted and fermented, and I don't think you want to try doing it at home. First of all, you'd have to move out. That's the first problem. And secondly, I don't know if you know, it's hard to get that right. I wouldn't know how to do that. But I have to borrow a leaf from two people, okay? Two people we've had on the show who really know their fish sauce. One is Bruce Cost, who did a book called Asian Ingredients. And the other one is this great chef in Seattle, Tom Douglas. And in fact, Tom did a piece with us about how to use up that fish sauce that you bought for the menu, you know, and you bought for one dish and it sits there forever. Tom stores his fish sauce in the fridge. And the brand I'm remembering from either one of them was a brand that had 3 crabs on the label. That's what stays in my mind. And that's what's sitting on my refrigerator door shelf right now. And it has a kind of gentle flavor to it.
Great.
Yeah, so I'd start there. See if it tastes like what you remember from Vietnam and Thailand.
I'll do that.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks. Thanks. That's a great question. I wish I really had a definite answer for you. Take care, Mark.
All right. Thank you.
Goodbye. You know, guys, it's fish sauce is like soy sauce. They do taste different. And like soy sauce, it's kind of interesting because they're not wildly expensive. if you're into this kind of cooking, buy a couple of different kinds. And you may not want to taste them, but you may want to sniff them and maybe mix them with a little vinegar or something like that and then taste them. And then you see what you kind of like. Or you might want a wardrobe of fish sauces. Only food crazies go this far. But if you're listening to the show, you're halfway down that path already. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. We've got Chip calling. So, Chip, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to thank you, first of all, for your great book and the show. I'm a longtime fan of both.
Hey, thank you. Thank you.
Lynn, during the last month or so, you've had two guests on, both of which have posed the dangers of green potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I had a question about exotic foods or restaurants, but this is pretty mundane.
I don't think green potatoes are mundane.
Okay.
But go ahead. What's
Here
the question?
It is. I think the first guest about a month ago said that not only do these contain toxins, but they tend to build up in your body.
Yeah, this was the scientific aspect of it, and from what I understand, yes, that's true.
Well, I'm a potato fanatic, and now I'm very worried. How do I undo this damage, first of all? And secondly, how do you detect it? If you're, I've noticed in preparing potatoes that much of the green is under the skin.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you bake a potato, you're not going to be aware of that. How do I protect myself against it if I can't see it?
Okay, this is a great question. And what we're talking about is that if you leave potatoes out in the light, or if they become extremely warm or extremely cold, there is a substance within them that evidently can really develop and become dangerous. It's an alkaloid, a form of alkaloid. And alkaloids exist in a lot of plants, evidently. It's kind of like the plant's protection. You know, it because some alkaloids can kill you, some can make you very sick. They're toxic. But I've always thought it was the way the plant defended itself against, you know, a human coming in and trampling on it. This is what you get if you treat me badly.
Sure.
Now, the way you tell if this has happened, first of all, store the potatoes away from light. They need air, but store them away from light and store them at room temperature.
Uh-huh.
So that means, let's say, for argument's sake, a basket in a cool, dark place. Don't put them in sunlight. Now, if you do that, you're okay. The other thing is the alkaloid, I always cut into a potato. Even if I'm going to bake it, I make a slash in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't hurt if you slash it in more than one place. And if you see a hint of green under the skin, if you just peel away that skin and any sign of green, the rest of the potato's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're all right there. Also, the alkaloids collect in the eyes of the potato. So if you have any sprouts or anything that looks like it's developing into a sprout, cut that away. And unless the potato is shriveled and, you know, just not looking very good, you can use the potato. So if you do those things, you're okay.
Then as soon as I hang up, Lynn, I'm going to go right up and take the potatoes I have out of my refrigerator.
Yeah, evidently. I used to store them in the fridge, too.
Okay.
And I, you know, I now keep them in cool room temperature. You know what I've got? I've got a corner under my cupboard, you know, on my counter in the kitchen.
Right.
And it's in shadow, and it's always in shadow, and it's away from the stove. And I just have a basket there, and that's where the potatoes go. And sometimes if I think of it, I throw a loose, like a cheesecloth over it.
Sure,
to keep the light
great.
Out. Yeah.
We're great in our kitchen.
Yeah, so that's all you have to worry about.
Good deal.
But it is not a mundane question at all, because it's the kind of thing a lot of us deal with and we're not sure about. So this is good, Chip.
Do you have any knowledge of how this buildup, if this buildup just continues indefinitely? I mean,
I don't know. That I don't know. That's where we need a physician or a scientist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lynn, I appreciate your help.
Hey, you're welcome, and thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Very much. Bye.
Butter is new status food. There are butter tastings in magazines. Fancy stores are carrying cultured butters from Europe. And local dairies across the country are creating butters that are becoming the darlings of chefs. Now, one of those dairies is Hope Dairy in the tiny Minnesota town of Hope. Farmer Victor Maratz bought a 93-year-old operation and started producing butter. His butter maker is Gene Kruckenberg. And Gene's with me in the studio. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, how did you become a butter maker?
Well, how I became a butter maker, I started working at a small creamery in 1958. at that creamery also, they made butter. So I got making butter with the manager at that time. And then in 1964, I was asked by another local creamery to become their manager.
Uh-huh.
So I've been at Hope then now ever since, 1964.
So how do you make butter?
You start out with cream, and you put it into a, well, first of all, you pasteurize it. And then after that, the next day, you pump it into the churn, and the churn goes around and around. And it takes about 30 minutes before it becomes little small particles of butter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you drain off the buttermilk, and then I run water on it, kind of rinse more of the buttermilk off, and then you add your salt, and then you start to churn up again and work the moisture and the salt into the butter, and that's about it.
That's it. All right, but the butter from Hope Dairy is pretty special. I mean, all these chefs are going nuts over it and whatever. In your opinion, what makes an exceptional butter?
Well, I guess one thing is we're still kind of make it the old-fashioned way, the equipment they used to use. I mean, we got the churn, it's a batch churn, instead of being a continuous churn.
Now, Gene, what is that, the batch churn? What does that mean?
Well, you pump the cream into, well, it's actually just like a big barrel, and so you pump it all into one big or one unit, and then you roll it around for about 30 minutes before it starts to form little butter chunks.
And how is that done in other butters?
Well, other butters, the cream comes in more or less one end, and it comes out the other end, a ribbon of butter or a stream of butter. I mean, it's real fast speed, so it's got kind of more of a whip texture.
Ah, so this butter is denser. Your butter
yeah,
is denser.
Yeah, more so, yeah.
So, Gene, what's it like for somebody who has made butter all their life to suddenly see that this product has become, you know, sort of hip, chic?
Well, I guess it's really interesting or nice to see that. I mean, locally, it has always been real liked. I mean, people that started eating it, they won't eat anything else. I mean, they don't think nothing else is butter.
Hey, thanks for coming in.
Okay, thanks.
Gene Kreckenberg is butter maker at the Hope Dairy in Hope, Minnesota. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Thomas Hardy. He said, "Some folk want their luck buttered." You can find all the information you will ever need on our website at splendidtable.org. Again, the address, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, drop us a line at the Splendid Table Forum and take a look at the Splendid Table store. There are some fun offbeat things there right now, including that chocolate bar I'm currently obsessing over. And all the proceeds go to support the show. Our show is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Enjoy the day and be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.